From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. Fire and Fury, Michael Wolff's controversial book about the Trump presidency, went on sale this morning. Wolff's publisher moved up the release date after President Trump's lawyers launched legal efforts to stop the book's publication, which had been slated for next week. Trump's press secretary, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, insisted this morning that author Michael Wolff never interviewed the president and that Wolff had begged to see Trump.
But on NBC's Today Show, Wolff pushed back.
I absolutely spoke to the president, whether he realized it was an interview or not. I don't know, but it certainly was not off the record. But even more to the point, I spoke to people who spoke to the president on a daily, sometimes minute-by-minute basis.
And the resulting book is an unflattering picture of an erratic Trump surrounded by people who question his ability to do the job. There's also a blockbuster story in today's New York Times, which says that President Trump tried to lobby Attorney General Jeff Sessions to not recuse himself from the Russia investigation because of his undisclosed contacts with the Russian ambassador, and that Special Counsel Robert Mueller, who is investigating obstruction of justice in that case, knows about it. So let's gather, convene our Friday Politics Roundtable. This week, Tolu Olorunipa, White House correspondent for Bloomberg News. Hi, Tolu.
Hey.
And Domenico Montanaro, NPR lead political editor. Hi, Domenico.
Hi there.
And Domenico, I want to start with you. You retweeted Walter Schaub, the former director of the Office of Government Ethics, who wrote that if the New York Times story is true, the White House lawyer that Trump asked to talk to Sessions and ask him not to recuse himself was asking Sessions to break the law. Tell us more.
Well, it's really fascinating. I mean, Walter Schaub has been somebody who, as the ethics chief in the United States, head of the Office of Government Ethics before he resigned, had taken to Twitter to tell the president to divest of his interests, of his business interests. He then apparently was talking to the White House and to the Justice Department saying that Sessions should recuse himself. There are must recuses and there are should recuses. In this case, they saw it as that he should recuse himself. He agreed, and that sent the president into a rage. He was infuriated by the fact that that Sessions recused himself from the Russia investigation. And according to the New York Times report from last night, he feels as if the attorney general should be somebody who protects the president in the way that he views it, as Robert F. Kennedy did for John F. Kennedy or Eric Holder for Barack Obama. The Eric Holder for Barack Obama thing, even though he'd said that he was President Obama's wingman, certainly that Justice Department held to far more protocol than this White House and Justice Department.
And Trump at the time was critical of Eric Holder. But tell us again, so why does Schaub think that this is breaking the law?
Well, he thinks that this is a problem when it comes to obstruction of justice. Mm-hmm. And that's what the centerpiece of the New York Times piece was yesterday, about the fact that I think what the overall picture from that Times piece presents is not just these details, but that the net there's a very loose net right now around President Trump as the target, as a target within this investigation. And usually what lawyers and investigators will tell you is you have three options. You can either you come in as a subject and you have the choice to be a witness or a target. And right now it looks like the president is in the target range for the Mueller investigation. Mm.
Tolu, let me get your take on that before we turn to more about Michael Wolff's book. But what do you make of the New York Times story?
Yeah, there were so many bombshells in that story. It's hard to even figure out where to start. But a couple of things that stuck out to me. One was where Attorney General Jeff Sessions, according to this report, was trying to solicit members of Congress to get dirt on the FBI Director Jim Comey to have one negative news story per day coming out about the FBI Director as President Trump was considering whether to fire him. That would just on its own be a huge bombshell if true. Now that the Justice Department has pushed back on it. But, you know, this reporter has broken a lot of stories and has pretty good sourcing in the past. So it's hard to tell exactly where the truth lies. Another thing is that President Trump was so adamant about trying to get rid of FBI Director Jim Comey that one of his top lawyers had to mislead him and tell him that he did not have the authority to do that because they were so worried that when the president fired Jim Comey that it would lead to all of the various things that we've actually now seen, a special prosecutor and various investigations into the president. So this is clearly something that, you know, aside from the whole idea of Russian collusion, this is sort of a problem that the president kind of created on his own with the firing of Jim Comey and the way it was handled and the way he's related with Jeff Sessions and some of the things that the Justice Department has done to really go push beyond the norms that had been set up by previous administrations.
Yeah. Well, of course, we should say the president tweeted this morning that the media is covering the book about him, Fire and Fury, so much because the Russia investigation is proving to be a total hoax. So trying to kind of circle around all the headlines today there with that tweet. But let's do move to the book because there's much about the Russia investigation in the book. And Michael Wolff on the Today Show today spoke. As we said, the book's publication was pushed up in response to the letter from the White House yesterday asking them not to publish it. And one of the things that Wolff said is that people closest to Trump said he's like a child demanding instant gratification. Let's listen.
They say he's a moron, an idiot. Let's remember, this man does not read, does not listen. So he's like a he's like a pinball, just shooting off the sides.
Domenico, this is actually hard to listen to. This is we're talking about the president of the United States.
Well, I mean, I don't know that anybody is completely surprised with Wolf's, you know, interpretation based on the way he talks to some of the sources within the White House. I'm not sure, you know, look, he's somebody who you know, the White House has dismissed as a tabloid-like reporter, you know, and a lot of this has to do with the lens through which you view the president. You know, and there have certainly been a lot of these – some of these details have come out previously. Remember when Rex Tillerson had to issue a non-denial denial that he had called the president a moron with an expletive in front of it, that H.R. McMaster didn't really think too highly of his intellect. I think a lot of what has happened with President Trump is that in the most positive way to look at him is that he has shook up Washington because he defies the norms that normally take place. He's defied the ways that Washington normally works. And that can certainly set off a lot of people who look at this and think, gosh, this is just not the way things should run. Now, that could mean that things are very problematic within the White House. It's certainly a huge political distraction when it comes to the Republican Party needing to get its stuff together and get legislation passed. You know, no one's talking about that tax plan anymore that was supposed to dominate the first part of this year. And no one's talking about what the next steps could be with infrastructure, which are supposed to be the big policy points. Instead, palace intrigue has been the thing that's dominated. And it's the kind of front and backstabbing that would make the Queen of England blush.
Well, Tolu, I just want to pick up on what I was meaning when we heard those words, moron, idiot, doesn't read, doesn't listen. I mean, supporters of President Obama know how they felt when they heard people on Fox News so personally disparaging their candidate. There are people in America right now hearing this and thinking that it's the same thing. And overall, it is such a coarsening. It's such a – I mean, it just seems like such an unfortunate chapter in history.
Yeah, and one of the things that makes this episode incredibly intriguing is the fact that a lot of this, a lot of these adjectives and descriptors are coming from people within the White House, and we know from looking at the White House that it has been a pretty chaotic place at times. You can look back at the travel ban, you can look back at Anthony Scaramucci's wild 11 days within the White House, and any observer looking from the outside would not be surprised by a lot of the things that are in Wolf's book, that this is this has been a chaotic White House where, you know, there's infighting and, you know, what's happened this week with Steve Bannon, the former chief strategist, now being thrown under the bus by the president. It's clear that the infighting and chaos within the White House is a true fact. Now, whether or not all of the details within Wolf's book are accurate, that's another story. But it's clear that that there has been this level of chaos, and the White House wanted to move beyond that with the tax bill, trying to get momentum from that and roll it over into infrastructure. And this book coming out even a couple days early has really sort of blown up that entire narrative. And that's why you see the White House trying to really delegitimized the book. Trump's lawyers issuing cease and desist letters. It's clear that they realize how big of a problem this is for the president, especially a president who has a fragile ego like the one that we have.
Domenico, we've just got under a minute here, but, you know, at Camp David this afternoon, the president is going to sit down with Republican leaders in Congress about their agenda. We've got the midterms to look forward to. I mean, how do you think they're going to try and seize back the political narrative right now?
Well, certainly you've got Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, and Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate, who have agendas that they want to get through. And the thing that we've been talking about before all of this kind of tabloid fodder exploded this week is the fact that there is a split between Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan on how to pursue that agenda. Ryan wants to go after welfare and entitlements. We know that the White House and President Trump want to also go after welfare, but in a different kind of way. Do they have the kind of votes to be able to get an agenda item as big as some of these things are through in an election year when things generally don't happen as much? We're going to see after this weekend.
Domenico Montanaro, NPR lead political editor. Tolu Olorunipa, White House correspondent for Bloomberg. Thank you.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
More than 3 months after its election, Germany still has no new government. Acting Chancellor Angela Merkel is struggling to form a governing coalition after the far-right Alternative for Germany, or AfD party, won enough votes to block the country's traditional consensus option. In a New Year's Eve speech, Merkel promised to work quickly. Efforts to form a governing consensus with Germany's center-left Social Democrats are expected to begin this weekend. NPR correspondent Soraya Sarhadi-Nelson joins us from Berlin. And Soraya, first of all, start off by telling us how or what Merkel said in her speech and how Germany got to this moment.
Well, it was a rather unusual message for her. She's usually very optimistic, but she basically is saying that everyone who comes and talks to her is very worried about this divided public opinion. And she speaks of a rare rift running through society. Certainly, the results in the elections demonstrate that. This very antagonistic far-right party was elected into the parliament, Alternative for Germany, as you mentioned. And the fact that she has been unable to get a consensus among various partners. I mean, it's not unusual for a German election not to have a majority or clear winner because it's a parliamentary system. Mm-hmm. But what is unusual is that she's just unable to get anybody to agree on some sort of program to move the country forward. And this is basically a final attempt this weekend to try and get at least her old governing coalition partners, the Social Democrats, to form a government with her.
Well, and suppose for a moment that these talks are successful. That would make the far-right AfD party the official opposition in the German parliament. So what would be the effect of that?
Well, certainly any attempt by the mainstream parties and Merkel to say that they will not deal with this party, they will not negotiate with this party, that all falls by the wayside. I mean, you cannot ignore the largest opposition party in parliament, which is what the AfD will become if the Social Democrats enter a governing coalition with Merkel, because the AfD is the third highest vote getter. And so that means that they will get certain committee leaderships, they will get extra money to run things, and so their message becomes much more prominent.
And tell us a little bit more about what some of the newly elected MPs from the AfD are doing. I mean, I understand that perhaps they're doing things like testing Germany's laws against racist content on social media.
Yeah, this is why, I mean, I've often argued that, you know, labeling is not necessarily a good thing, and to call them far right maybe is not correct based on their social platform. But they certainly have taken very far right stances in public comments that they're making. We're talking about Beatrix von Storch and Jens Meyer. They are now among the more extreme members, and they basically posted tweets on New Year's Eve that were very racist. Von Storch accused Cologne police, for example, of pandering to Muslims, whom she described as, quote, barbaric and, quote, a gang-raping male horde. And this was a very crude reference to widespread groping attacks in Cologne 2 years ago by what victims said were men who looked Arab and North African. Now, what happened as a result of this tweet is that Twitter removed it and shut down her account for 12 hours. And now she actually faces possible prosecution for incitement, which is a pretty big deal in Germany.
Now, what is at stake for Merkel herself, though, right? Because I understand her popularity is dropping, and if she's not able to form another government, what would that mean for her political career? Would Germany have to have another election?
Well, that's certainly the direction that we're headed. I mean, there is an alternative, and that is that Merkel head a minority government. She doesn't want to do that. I mean, she wants to have a majority coalition, you know, or at least agreement on major issues. So if there's a new election, it's really going to hurt her. I mean, we're talking about a period in time at the moment where polls show 2/3 of Germans see her political career as in its waning days, that basically it's over for her, and that they would like to see new leadership of her conservatives, even though there's no alternative right now.
I wonder how the European Union more broadly is looking at Germany's political challenges right now, because, of course, it's the most powerful country in the European Union. Brexit is still looming. Does Germany's lack of a government at this point in time, is that worrisome to EU member states?
The European Union, certainly countries that are aligned with Merkel more politically and economically, they're very concerned about what's going on. We look at French President Emmanuel Macron, who has reforms he wants to push through, and Merkel can't commit to him because she doesn't have a government. I mean, she's head of a caretaker government. And at the same time, you have a lot of policies, for example, refugee policies, which Merkel has championed, which are now being trampled upon by other countries that are against it because they sense weakness. So the EU is really facing serious difficulties if this inability to form a government in Germany drags on in 2018.
Well, NPR correspondent Soraya Sarhadi-Nelson joined us from Berlin. Soraya, thank you so very much.
You're welcome, Meghna.
Well, back here in the United States, television networks are rolling out their plans for the next 6 months at the first TV Critics Press Tour of the year. It's just getting underway, and there is a lot of pressure on 21st Century Fox executives to answer how the company is going to survive, given the sale of much of its holdings to Disney. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans is checking out the tour. He joins us from Pasadena, California. And Eric, 21st Century Fox struck that deal with Disney last month, $52 billion. Have executives given any more clarity about what the future holds?
No. Well, what's interesting here is that basically under the terms of this deal, Fox would take its TV studio that makes a lot of the programming for its primetime network. That would go to Disney. And a lot of cable channels that it has would also go to Disney, like FX. Now, what modern networks have been doing is they've been building this infrastructure where they are a media company with a lot of different platforms. So you look at NBC, for example, and they have a broadcast network. They have a studio that makes their TV shows. They have a suite of cable channels and they all kind of work together sometimes. Fox is dismantling that a little bit in this deal. And so everybody's sort of wondering, like, what is the Fox network going to look like once the deal closes? And so I spent some time talking to two people who are co-chairs of Fox, Gary Newman and Dana Walden. And both of them said the deal's not going to close for a year to a year and a half. They're going to try to have business as usual as much as they can. But there's a sense that they might have a little more flexibility because they're not tied down to a studio and they can make deals with independent producers. Now, if you're somebody who has a lot of options, you're very talented, you're somebody who makes TV, and you're a big name, are you going to place a show on Fox when there's so much uncertainty about what that network will be like in a year and a half or so when your show finally hits the air? I think right now their job is to kind of assure Hollywood that the Fox network will continue, the network that brings us The Simpsons and The X-Files and shows like that, that will continue beyond this deal.
Okay. So let's talk about another sort of larger cultural moment and how that might play out in television. You know, I'm talking about the Me Too moment the fact that we as a nation are talking a lot more about sexual harassment. Do you see the possibility of that making its way into the stories on television?
I don't think there's any doubt. And we're already seeing it. Shows like Law & Order that have a lot of flexibility and can jump on topics are certainly tackling this. I think we're going to see original series that will also talk about these issues. But what's really interesting is what's going on behind the scenes. There's been this commission on sexual harassment that's been convened that Anita Hill is going to chair. And everyone may remember Anita Hill is the woman who came forward to accuse Clarence Thomas U.S. of sexual harassment. She's going to lead this commission that is being backed by some of the biggest names in Hollywood. There's also a movement called Time's Up that's being supported by a lot of high-profile women in Hollywood, including Shonda Rhimes and Reese Witherspoon and America Ferrera. And they have put together a legal defense fund for people who feel that they may have experienced sexual harassment. They've collected over $14 million already.
Well, Eric, honestly, one can only hope that these women and these new groups are really successful, right? Because this is a huge reckoning that's going on in Hollywood. I'm wondering if the conversation there right now is that it's a reckoning that's long overdue.
I think so. You know, Hollywood, because of its reputation as being a sort of a liberal bastion or a bastion of artistic ideas and freedom, has long been exempted from the kind of scrutiny that we've given to corporate America on these issues of diversity and gender equality and sexual harassment. And now, finally, we have this sense that Hollywood is being held to account and being forced to live up to its perception. And there are a lot of powerful people in Hollywood who are stepping up to try and help this happen. I think we're going to see some progress. We're certainly going to talk about it a lot here at the TV Critics Press Tour. Rose McGowan, a woman who is at the center of the Harvey Weinstein scandal and has, you know, accused him of raping her. She's going to be here, and I'm sure folks are going to ask her questions about how she feels about all these efforts. And hopefully we will see Hollywood held to account in a way that it hasn't been before now.
Yeah. Well, before I let you go, Eric, one last question about stuff we actually might see on screens, but I'm thinking more streaming content, right? Netflix and Amazon and Hulu. What do you think we can expect from them this year?
More.
lots more. The
short answer. Netflix is talking about spending up to $8 billion on new content in 2018. Amazon is in this position where it has to redefine itself. Its top content executive was ousted amid sexual harassment allegations, and it's had a mandate from Jeff Bezos, the owner of Amazon, to develop more content that's more broad-based, that appeals to a wider audience than maybe the artistic niche-y kind of stuff that it's been doing. Hulu is going to be building on the success of The Handmaid's Tale, which is a big hit for them, and Apple TV is going to be stepping forward with new TV content. They've hired a bunch of executives from Hollywood. You know, it's just going to add to the wonderful cornucopia of, you know, shows that are out there for everyone right now.
Well, NPR TV critic Eric Deggans is keeping track of all the developments at the TV Critics Winter Press Tour. Eric, it's great to talk with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Christians worldwide celebrate the Epiphany tomorrow. It's also known as Three Kings Day, when the three wise men are said to have traveled to Bethlehem to bestow gifts upon the newborn Jesus. In Puerto Rico, it's an official holiday, and many Puerto Ricans who live off the island return to celebrate, but not this year. And after Hurricane Maria, thousands of Puerto Ricans who never planned to leave the island are spending their first Three Kings Day in the cold Northeast. New England Public Radio's Jill Kaufman reports.
In Puerto Rico, Santa Claus is strictly second tier.
My grandmother tells the story how she remembers as a little girl, the first time she saw Santa Claus in Ponce, she cried because she didn't know who that guy was.
Nelson Roman's grandmother from Puerto Rico is now 75, born before the island became a commonwealth of the U.S.
As Latinos, right, even before the U.S., even before Christmas, we were rooted exactly in that European Spaniard mentality. So because that was brought by Isabel, you know, and Ferdinand from Spain to these island nations.
Today, Nelson and his grandmother live in Holyoke, Massachusetts. He's a city councilor and is running this year's Three Kings Day celebration. Nelson says even if you aren't religious, as a child, you know if you put hay under your bed for the wise men's camels, you'd wake up to gifts. Before Hurricane Maria hit her home along the eastern coast of Puerto Rico, that's what 17-year-old Mayra Angelique Rojas de Leon and her sister did every year.
But I have never seen a Santa Claus out of school, but I always saw the Three Kings, but they are in horses because in Puerto Rico there's no camels, and I see them once in motorcycles.
When she was little, Mayra Angelique would try every year to stay awake to greet them. She never could. In the morning, she would open her eyes. There was grass all over the place. Her father blamed the camels, and the wise men had left their gifts.
So I always believe in them.
Now it's a frigid day in Holyoke, and Myra Angelique is sitting in the lobby of a hotel right off the highway. Several families from Puerto Rico are being housed here by FEMA. A month after the hurricane, she started as a senior at Holyoke High School. Her mother, Amarillis de Leon, and others from Puerto Rico sitting with them say they'll miss their holiday traditions, the food, the drink, the sweets, and the parrandas, the parties that go from house to house between Christmas and Three Kings Day.
Ensalada de papa, de codito, flanes.
Maybe next year. As of the end of December, more than 800 people from Puerto Rico have come to Holyoke. Francesca Roman, her husband, and their three young sons arrived at the hotel on Christmas Day. Their home on the northern coast of Puerto Rico was destroyed. If they were on the island, they'd be getting ready to host a big Three Kings Day party. About 200 people, Francesca and her husband Henry say, they'd make a big pork dish and other food, and they'd put hay outside under a tree for the three kings and their camels. But this year, in a hotel, there's no kitchen. They don't know what they'll do, and they don't have pato, grass for the kids to put under their beds. The most important thing at the moment, she says, is we're together as a family. Amarillis, who's been here the longest, tells Francesca she'll show her how to get the kids in school. And she tells them about the Three Kings celebration tomorrow. It's at one of the elementary schools in Holyoke. Three Kings will show up and hand out presents to every child. For Here and Now, I'm Jill Kaufman.
So have you set a New Year's goal? We're about to meet a man who's combined two important ones, staying fit and making a difference. Cos Marte is a former convict who now runs a gym in New York that promises clients a ripped prison body, and all of the trainers are formerly incarcerated. NPR's Netta Ulaby has more.
The original con body is tricked out to look like a jail, with gray-painted walls and a cell door that clangs shut whenever workouts begin. A mural shows inmates escaping through a gap in a chain-link fence. But Conbody clients pay $30 a class to be here. They're all professionals, mostly white, and intent on the exercises developed when the gym's founder was behind bars.
The prison bus.
None of this feels like a weird prison role-playing experience to the guy behind the front desk. It's a job, says Jamal Campbell, who started working here fairly recently.
5 months ago, straight from prison, right to Conbody.
Campbell's crimes?
Drugs, robbery.
After 15 years in the system, Campbell says he's grateful for a job. That's something Conbody's founder, Cos Marte, knows all too well.
When I came home from prison, nobody wanted to hire me, and every time I checked that box, I felt ashamed.
The box stating he was a convicted felon. Starting his gym in a Bowery basement was a struggle. No one wanted to rent to Marte. Another challenge?
I couldn't get business insurance because of my background.
But Marte took part in a program that helps former convicts start legit businesses. Over the past year, he's opened up a second gym and pop-ups in fancy department stores.
I'm in Saks Fifth Avenue, you know, like, beat that.
And Lord & Taylor. Then his contract with the prison Rikers Island.
We train the inmates in there to become certified trainers. We're working on creating a direct pipeline from the inside out.
And his TED Talk, and his online exercise classes, and his book coming out.
March 2018, pre-order now.
Oh, and a documentary in the works by Academy Award-nominated director Deborah Granick.
She's been following me around since I came out of prison.
Now investors want to help Marte expand nationally, and a famous fashion designer wants him to collaborate on leisure wear based on
prison jumpsuits.
All of it raising awareness, Marte says. He still teaches about 10 classes every week. One client, 22-year-old Ivy Wanta, says forget the prison shtick. It's inspiring to go to a gym staffed with people so happy to be there.
It's the most amazing place to work out, I think. I come here almost every day.
You're going to take your booty and you're going to scoot it over towards your ankle.
As Cos Marte heads into 2018, he says one of the best parts of running Conbody is reminding people that the line between formerly incarcerated people and privileged ones need not be a great and surpassable divide.
It's a blessing. It's a blessing to bring both worlds together.
Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
There's going to be a voice missing from the NPR choir after today. It's thoughtful. It has gravitas. It's our bass.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. Today, a random
Robert Siegel is retiring today after more than 40 years at NPR, 30 as co-host of All Things Considered, a radio career that started when he covered the 1968 demonstrations at his alma mater, Columbia University, if you believe Wikipedia, which he would tell us not to. And always, even on his first day reporting for ATC in 1987, he exuded a calm authority.
Venezuela is likely to send a right-wing terrorist back to his native Italy. He's wanted there for
Robert Siegel earned some of this industry's highest awards, including a coveted cameo on The Simpsons. Who can forget when the curmudgeonly Mr. Burns watches as a wing of his mansion is destroyed, and Robert shows up with a boombox?
The Antonin Scalia bedroom.
It's a National Public Radio broadcast center now.
Who are you?
I'm Robert Siegel, and this is All Things Considered.
And he had the respect of colleagues. In 2015, Laura Larson told Scott Simon about how working at NPR prepared her to be a Jeopardy contestant.
The way I got through the day every day was don't disappoint Robert Siegel. Don't let Robert Siegel down by letting something wrong get on the air.
Demonstrations of Robert Siegel's commitment to the facts and to holding people in power accountable come daily. But in 2005, after Katrina hit New Orleans, NPR had reporters on the ground telling us about people on rooftops waiting for rescue, floating corpses, and at the New Orleans Convention Center, more than 2,000 people in horrific conditions, no water or food. The Homeland Security Chief Michael Chertoff was overseeing the operations and seemed unaware.
We are hearing from our reporter, and he's on another line right now, thousands of people at the convention center in New Orleans with no food.
Well,
zero.
You know, as I said, I'm telling you that we are getting food and water to areas where people are staging. And, you know, it's, the one thing about an episode like this is if you talk to someone and you get a rumor or you get someone's anecdotal version of something, I think it's dangerous to extrapolate it all over the place. The limitation
the
here on the ground, and as soon as we can physically move through the ground with these assets, we're going to do that. So,
Ms. Secretary, when you say that we shouldn't listen to rumors, these are things coming from reporters who have not only covered many, many other hurricanes, they've covered wars and refugee camps.
Well,
I mean, these aren't rumors; they're seeing thousands of people there.
And then there is also the Robert Siegel of unbound intellectual curiosity and bemusement. And that brings us to this conversation from 2016 with a comedian and voice actor, John Benjamin, who released an experimental jazz album. Emphasis on experimental.
This track is called I Can't Play Piano. I'm sorry, I can't say it. This is called I Can't Play Piano, Part 2, and it's obvious you can't play piano.
I really can't, and it really shows.
and yet here you are playing with some guys who seem to know what they're doing quite
well.
They
were very accomplished jazz musicians that I played with and me.
The name of this album is... Well, I should have subtitled Learn to Play the Piano.
It's very literal.
Well,
that is real untapped untalent. He's good.
Yeah, he knows what he's doing, yeah.
He really does.
Yeah.
But that's just not as interesting.
You think it lacks the complete sense of freeform surprise that we have when you're actually...
He's not taking any risk. He just knows how to do it.
How safe to actually...
I feel bad for people like that, yeah.
In an interview this week, WBUR's All Things Considered host Lisa Mullins told Robert he was the voice of NPR and asked about his legacy.
I'm not the voice of NPR. There are lots of great voices on NPR, and broadcast journalism is a team sport. I hope that what all of us leave here to people is a journalism, a broadcasting that's based on interesting, rational discourse that's not just about insult and vituperation, but that addresses the real curiosities of Americans, who deserve to get a straight take on what's happening in their country and around the world. That's a pretty ambitious legacy, but I think NPR has done pretty well over the past few decades.
This afternoon on ATC, Robert Siegel will say goodbye for himself. But for now, from all of us at Here and Now, thank you, Robert, for informing, questioning, maintaining your dignity, making us laugh. Please, come up with a recipe for something like cranberry relish, like Susan Stamberg did, so we can hear from you forever.
I was in the Persian Gulf state of Qatar.
In West Berlin, this is Robert Siegel.
Atop the levee at Hannibal, Missouri.
In the north of Moscow.
At the softball field in Hemingford, Quebec. This Little League stadium is in a big Havana sports complex. In Silivri, an outer suburb of Istanbul.
I'm on the Avenue Habib Bourguiba, which is the main drag of Tunis.
I met Ken Emanuelson for lunch at a downtown Dallas cafe.
In Chillicothe, Ohio. This is Robert Siegel.
I caught up with Beagle at Kay's, the hamburger joint in Troy, Ohio.
In a shoe repair shop, one block from Red Square.
And I'm Robert Siegel in Jerusalem, in the eastern Slovakia.
Listeners, leave your goodbyes for Robert with this story at hereandnow.org.
Well, yesterday, much of the East Coast had that major winter storm that dropped up to 18 inches of snow in places. Today, the bitter cold is back. Schools in many communities remain closed, and authorities are advising drivers to use caution because of icy conditions. Yesterday, a Singapore Airlines passenger jet headed to New York from Frankfurt. It had to make an emergency landing at a small airport 80 miles north of the city because of runway closures at Kennedy International Airport. Ground transportation then took the passengers to New York City. FlightAware.com says that more than 1,000 flights today have been canceled. Well, it was a different kind of storm that the marijuana industry was dealing with yesterday after Attorney General Jeff Sessions rescinded an Obama administration policy that essentially removed marijuana from the list of federal drug enforcement priorities. Sessions has long opposed marijuana legalization. He's called it, quote, a real danger. And marijuana does remain illegal under federal law. But it's still unclear what impact, if any, the Justice Department change will have in states where recreational pot is legal. Colorado was the first to legalize it in 2014, and recreational marijuana is now a billion-dollar industry there. Ben Marcus from Colorado Public Radio reports.
The memo from Sessions was clear. Marijuana is a dangerous drug, and marijuana activity is a serious crime. His prosecutors can go after people and businesses without restriction.
I mean, I think this is a major shot across the bow from the federal government.
Brian Vicente is the author of Amendment 64, which legalized cannabis in Colorado. He says this upends other Justice Department memos that offered guidelines for marijuana prosecution that were more restrictive, basically saying as long as states keep marijuana out of the hands of kids and clamp down on out-of-state distribution, they'd be left alone.
And in one sweep of his pen, Sessions got rid of all those memos, right? So now we are back at a place where local prosecutors have essentially unfeathered power to prosecute marijuana cases as they see fit.
But Colorado's U.S. attorney released a statement saying he'd go about business as usual. Republican Senator Cory Gardner, though, was angry. He took to the Senate floor demanding to know why Sessions was trampling on the will of the people and breaking a promise to him to leave state marijuana laws alone.
One tweet later, one policy later, a complete reversal. And without any notification, conversation, or dialogue with Congress. Completely reversed.
Gardner said he'd hold up Justice Department nominations until he got answers. Still, despite the bipartisan help, this isn't good news for Colorado's industry. Sam Kamen is a constitutional law professor at the University of Denver. He says the federal ban on marijuana has never changed.
You know, the thing I always tell people when they're asking, should I get into this business, should I do this, is, you know, it depends how well you want to sleep at night.
That's a level of risk that businesses have lived with all along, says Sean McAllister, a marijuana attorney in Denver.
The entrepreneurs that are willing to work in the cannabis space understand the risk, and they've been profiting from it.
And he's confident the Sessions memo won't change that, that public sentiment has shifted in favor of marijuana, and federal prosecutors will find something better to do with their time.
We expect that U.S. attorneys around the country will continue to look at cannabis and determine, is it more important to go after a regulated industry with state licenses that pays taxes, that employs people, or to focus on black market actors that are not following the rules?
Sessions' actions are really about recreational marijuana. When it comes to medical marijuana, Congress has explicitly instructed federal prosecutors to leave it alone. Christy Kelly runs the Marijuana Industry Group and is a former dispensary owner. She hopes that Colorado can avoid the worst of any potential crackdown because the state is unique in its approach.
Colorado has one of the most complex and well-thought-out regulatory systems in the country, and I would offer in the world.
And her advice to businesses now is to follow those laws very closely.
Keep marijuana in the hands of the people that are supposed to have it and out of the hands of the people that aren't supposed to have it. Pay your taxes and be a good steward of this model.
Because she says it would only take a few bad actors to jeopardize the whole industry, which paid more than $200 million in state taxes in the first 10 months of last year. Others, though, have welcomed the Sessions memo. Henny Lasley runs Smart Colorado, which is against the widespread commercialization of marijuana.
What we hope will come out of this is a continued discussion around the need for education and awareness about the highly potent THC marijuana products that are sold every day in the state of Colorado.
She believes the public health concerns around those products have not been a large enough part of the conversation as the country has barreled towards legalization. That's a movement, though, that advocates say will not stop because of Attorney General Jeff Sessions. Again, the author of Colorado's legalization initiative, Brian Vicente.
I firmly believe that Michigan and New Jersey will legalize marijuana this year, join the other nine states. We're going to continue to see this popular movement.
But he says Sessions' move is clearly a bad turn for marijuana legalization. How bad a turn is anyone's guess right now. For Here and Now, I'm Ben Marcus.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.